Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time television program binge watcher.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that considers the annual Academy Awards show to be its version of the Super Bowl, or better yet, the Olympics, which may be more appropriate considering that at least one of the films we'll be discussing on this week's show involves the 1972 Summer Games. That film is director and co-screenwriter Tin Fellbaum's September 5th, which stars Peter Sarsgaard and John Magaro. Before we get to that film, though, we'll tackle Rommel Ross's Nickel Boys, another period piece, this one set mostly in a Florida reform school circa the early 1960s. Let's begin there. Elwood, played by Ethan Harris, is a good young man, shy, conscientious, and smart. But when he accepts a ride from a stranger, who just happens to be a car thief, he gets charged with theft as well and is sent to the Nickel Academy, a reform school for minors. There he is befriended by Turner, played by Brandon Wilson, and the two struggle against the corrupt policies of the school's directors, one of whom is played by Hamish Linklater. Director Rommel Ross and screenwriter Jocelyn Barnes adapted their film from Colson Whitehead's 2019 novel, and the conceit they use is clever. The story's chronology switches back and forth, and much of what occurs early on is portrayed from each character's point of view, the purpose of which ultimately becomes clear. Ross's narrative style and both the two central performances fuel the power of the film's overall plot, which, being based on a real-life case of such a Florida facility, is already as powerful as a punch to the heart and well worth its Oscar nominations for Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay, if not more.
And the Colson Whitehead novel that this is based on, which also won a Pulitzer, I think it's the second of his novels to win a Pulitzer, is one of the best books I've maybe ever read. And it has such a shattering epilogue, which is sort of alluded to a little bit, that changes everything that came before it. And when I heard that they were making Nickel Boys into a movie, I really didn't think they were going to be able to pull off that final bit of narrative. I don't want to give anything away, but I do wonder if Ross sort of worked backward from that moment to figure out how he was going to film this movie. And I think it ultimately works, but it's completely of a piece with his debut feature, Hale County, This Morning, This Evening, which was an Oscar-nominated documentary from years back. That was one where he had compiled thousands of hours of impressionistic, fly-on-the-wall, sometimes free-of-context footage of these families living in Alabama, these black families living there, and turned it into this very strange meditation on, well, all sorts of things. And I think this is a movie, although on a much bigger budget and with, you know, an actual narrative script, I think it has a lot of the same qualities. He's definitely indebted to Terrence Malick. There are moments at the beginning of Nickel Boys that feel like the opening passage of his film, The Tree of Life.
That is certainly not the worst thing to be compared to.
And the fact that I'm thinking of The Tree of Life while watching this movie, I mean that as a very high compliment. And all the way through the movie, I kept thinking, is this first-person perspective thing a gimmick? Is it just a hook to sell the movie? But I think it ultimately does really just give this movie so much more weight because, I mean, it's a movie about these historical atrocities, recent historical atrocities, but we're seeing it through the eyes of the people who are on the receiving end of them. And it also becomes a study in how these characters look at one another, how they look at the world, what they feel comfortable looking at, because we're literally looking through their eyes. Sometimes we'll see them make eye contact with someone and then avert their gaze. They become hyper aware, or we become hyper aware of how other people are looking at them, especially white people looking at them.
They live in a world of threat. I mean, there's this haunting thing over them.
So. And so that first person style actually underlines all of those things, but in a way that doesn't feel heavy handed. And so even though at the beginning I thought, am I going to be able to get into the rhythms of this movie? I think eventually you do, especially as it changes up points of view, as it goes ahead into the future, as there are moments where we see footage from other sources and we wonder what they are, including the Stanley Kramer film, The Defiant Ones, which reminded me of James Baldwin's kind of dissertation on that movie. There's a lot going on in this movie. It feels very restless, but I think ultimately The Nickel Boys is really powerful and does justice to the novel, which I think
is most
important.
Yeah, it's very true to the novel. It is. I mean, the pacing is a little bit different and so forth.
The novel is written from the third-person perspective.
Yeah, so I think that, and let's be clear, Nickel Academy was based, as you pointed out, on a real school in Florida, the Dozier School. And supposedly they were going to make a shift to have a more, I mean, this was the time period where juveniles were to be viewed as, you know, works in progress, and it was a more social work approach. But that didn't make its way down over the border to this particular establishment in Northwest Florida, because this Nickel Academy was, I mean, when you first come upon it, it looks beautiful. And the way that he chooses to film it was very interesting, too, because our protagonist, Elwood, is in a car with two teenage white boys. And so they're coming up to this place and you think, oh, well, it looks pretty good. And then you start to realize, oh, it really doesn't look that great. And more important, there's a huge divide between the facilities that are available for the white kids and the black kids. And so as a result of that, that sets the tone for what we're dealing with, you know, right away. The other thing I think that we should point out, as you mentioned, there were atrocities that happened to these kids outside of their stay at the academy, but there are also huge problematic disciplinary approaches used, but we don't see what's happening. And so I think that was a really wise decision on the part of the filmmaker to make sure that we understand that these horrors are happening, but we don't deal with it directly. We sort of get it from the perspective of the other boys who are listening to what's happened in the so-called ice cream factory.
Or perhaps this is kind of his way of showing repression of memory, because a lot of the Nickel Boys film feels like we're looking back at memories or someone's dreams, or maybe more appropriately, nightmares.
Correct.
It has that quality to it.
Yeah, I want to point out that as powerful and as important as the message that the film Nickel Boys gets across, what I was really impressed with was how well Ross directed this movie. Before the show began, we were talking about the Steven Soderbergh film Presence, which we'll review at a later date. And whether you like Soderbergh's films or not, and I like almost all of them, what I appreciate is that there's a smart guy behind the camera. And that's how I feel about Ross. At first, as you pointed out, Nathan, I was a little confused about why is he doing this, what this? And then I got into what was going on, and I just think it's a masterful film. And, you know, we always talk about Richard Brody of The New Yorker, and he's a contrarian. He thinks Nickel Boys is the best film of the year, and I have to agree with him. For once, I do agree with Richard Brody.
Well, there you go. I also want to talk, we've, in discussing The Nickel Boys, talked about the visuals. I want to talk about the sound of the movie, because seeing this in a movie theater and you're enveloped in that sound, I realize that it's very much an important component in getting us in the headspace of these characters, because even though the first part of the movie is from Elwood's point of view, we start to realize that we're also seeing things from Turner's point of view, and it kind of goes back and forth. Sometimes within the same scene, we see the same course of events through each of their eyes. But the way that the sound is used to put us in that sort of dream space, because the movie is kind of floating from one thing to another. Mm-hmm. And there are little sounds, you know, the sound of a bird in a faraway tree, the sound of a knife on a plate, all of those little details that I think give us, you know, the sense of really being engrossed in this world that is both beautiful and terrifying, and sometimes at the same time. I mean, the way that he walks that line is really impressive.
Well, and I think that we haven't talked too much about the acting performances, and I thought that they were also superb.
Yeah.
And also, Elwood's grandmother plays actually a more significant role in the book, but she appears periodically in this particular film. And Anjanae Ellis
Taylor
plays that particular role. I thought she was great.
She's so good in this.
Well, and the other thing is, too, of course, someone such as myself has a lot of faith and hope in the legal system. And we can see how that completely failed here. And as a matter of fact, they're, you know, trying for this appeal and they get ripped off by this attorney. And that was just so sad. That was sad, along with all the other sadness. That was just another injustice.
I think my favorite scene ultimately in the movie is one that happens near the end of Nickel Boys, and it's with David Diggs, who plays
Chicky Pete,
character in, yes, that scene, but he plays a character in the future, and he encounters another Nickel Boy at a bar in Brooklyn, I think it is, in the 1980s. And the way that that is shot, it's one take pretty much that goes on seemingly forever.
Yeah.
And even though there is no real threat happening in that scene, at least compared to the other parts, it's harrowing in a way that I was not expecting. And again, it just kind of starts to reveal what Ross is really up to.
And it sets up that reveal. And it's just wonderful. I can't say enough good things about Nickel Boys. At any rate, that was our discussion of Nickel Boys. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to discuss September 5th. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
70% of our listeners prefer to purchase products and services from public radio program underwriters, according to a recent NPR survey. Spokane Public Radio listeners appreciate program underwriters because they also help support the station and programs they listen to each and every day. You can find information about becoming a program underwriter and our current underwriters on our website at SpokanePublicRadio.org under Business Support Underwriting. Through this relationship, we can all help keep the region growing strong, whether it's our diverse business community or Spokane Public Radio.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the film Nickel Boys, which is one of 10 Best Picture Oscar nominees. Let's now turn to a film that earned an Oscar nomination for Best Original Screenplay. Three names are listed on that nomination, screenwriters Moritz Bender and Alex David, along with director Tim Fellbaum. But the sad fact is that this film deserves much more. It's an attempt to capture what it was like during the 1972 Summer Olympics when a group of terrorists broke into the Olympic Village and took a number of Israeli athletes hostage. But unlike any number of articles, books, and movies that have told the story, Fellbaum's movie is a look at the ABC sports team that found itself covering the ultimately tragic events. Fellbaum puts us in the room with the likes of the president of ABC Sports, Rune Arledge, played by Peter Sarsgaard, as he and head of operations Marvin Bader, played by Ben Chaplin, and control room director Jeffrey Mason, played by John Magaro, struggle to find the right way to portray what's happening while debating the ethics of journalism itself. Can we, as one person asks, show a person being shot on live TV? Side note, imagine any reality show producer these days asking that question. Intense throughout, despite our already knowing how things turned out, September 5th is another in a long line of excellent journalistic studies. And among the nominations the Academy might have considered, a chief one would be for Best Supporting Actress to Leonie Benesch as Marianne Gebhardt, whose role as a translator proves to be of paramount importance to the ABC crew of men she worked with.
September 5th seems particularly timely at this point because we do have a lot of questions about the media. We have a lot of questions about international relations in the Middle East and so forth. So even though we're talking about an event that happened 50 years ago, and as Dan indicated, we know the outcome. Although it's interesting, I wonder if everyone who goes to this movie will know the outcome in advance because, you know, it did happen such a long time ago. But this sort of plays out like a thriller. Even though the focal point of the action is going to be largely in this control room with these journalists who are trying to decide how to cover this story as it happens. And I thought that the way that this is filmed, you know, we get totally sucked into the decision making that they have to go through. It also shows how complicated it is. Shout out to Cassie, our producer here, to produce anything, especially back in the day where they were relying on passing back film footage surreptitiously and so forth. So, I mean, you do get involved in watching this. And then all of a sudden you'll remember, oh, there's this other hugely significant event that's playing out here. And I think that people in the newsroom felt the same way. We have this job to do. And yet in what way do we want to present it? They're fighting with people back in New York because, of course, news wants to take over. And they hold the line and say, no, hey, yeah, we're sports, but we're professional broadcast journalists, too, so we can do this job.
They have to even fight on the ground because Peter Jennings, who's part of the crew, keeps telling them, hey, guys, this is over your heads. You should.
Well, yeah,
you
it's know. So funny because he is a news guy, but yeah. He is on the scene to provide some context. Maybe he thought it was going to be a vacay, but it turns into something quite other than that. But I think what's been lauded about this film in particular are the performances by such notable actors as Peter Sarsgaard. But as Dan points out, it really are the new people on the scene. John Magaro, we recognize him. But I think that if you were going to focus on the individual performances, you know, they seem to be fungible characters until we realize that they're not, that they have their own unique personalities and thoughts and offerings and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, in this movie, September 5th is almost a deliberately incomplete picture of this event. And I think I don't disagree with some of the criticisms that have sort of dogged
surfaced,
this movie
yeah.
because of the time in which it's being released, that it does feel simplistic in a political sense. But I think if you think of this movie as one piece of a larger puzzle, and I would point people to the Kevin MacDonald documentary One Day in September, to Steven Spielberg's
Correct.
Film Munich. I think if you watch all of those with this one, then you get a more complete picture of what's going on. Yeah. This is about what's happening in that control room.
That's right.
And the ethical decision-making that they have to go through
exactly.
about what's appropriate
exactly.
to show
and,
or
and
screen.
And ultimately it does touch on how screwed up the German police were in trying to handle the situation.
Sure.
So it's not like it avoids politics, but it is very narrow in scope with what
yes.
the film is trying to do.
I don't think I liked it, though, as much as either of you, although I did ultimately get pulled into it. I mean, how can you not, especially having actually worked in a newsroom? And, like, we've seen things go down
Absolutely.
In real time in a newsroom.
Yep.
I was never part of anything this intense, but you can kind of imagine what it would have been like. And I think mainly I felt like it was a little bit dramatically incomplete. When the movie ended, I went, oh, okay, I guess that's it, which I think is part of Feldbaum's point, because ultimately this is just a day at work for these people. They have to come back to the office the next day, despite having gone through all this. But I also didn't really get a sense of who many of these characters were. You sort of alluded to that, MP. We get glimpses into their personal philosophies. There are a couple big monologues about, you know, the importance of objectivism in journalism and doggedly following a story, even if the powers that be tell you that you can't. For me, the most effective thing about September 5th was the how-to element of it. You also alluded to this, which is how they made live TV with all of this analog technology, the way they're communicating through walkie-talkies, the way that they're getting updates through their teletype machines, the way that they put captions on the screen with actual plastic letters and then they superimpose that onto the image, the way that they create slow-mo by literally moving the film reel slower so it goes frame by frame. That was the stuff that I actually gravitated most towards in this movie.
But, you know, in terms of Oscars, which is one of the points I like to make, and we like to debate, ooh, did this film deserve Oscars
or not?
We love
talking about the Oscars despite the fact that they're stupid.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, even if you don't like ultimately, or say you and I might disagree on how good this film is, I think it should have been one of the 10 nominees for Best Film. But even if you don't agree with that, Best Editing, Best Sound Design, and particularly Best Supporting Actress for Leonie Benesch. I mean, Felicity Jones gets a nomination and this woman doesn't.
Well,
it's
let's
just
not
ridiculous.
Denigrate Felicity Jones.
I know.
Well, and so the actress that you're talking about, she was in the German film The Teacher's Lounge.
Yes.
And I thought she was good in that movie, even though I didn't like The Teacher's Lounge all that much. Her performance is probably the best thing in it. And I liked her character in this because, and you mentioned this in your intro, that she's trying to navigate this newsroom that's male dominated, as they continue to be, let's be honest. But
she's actually the interpreter.
Yeah, and they keep sending her to, you know, the men are like, huh, sweetie, can you go get us some coffee? And they send her out of the room, and then they're like, what is this guy saying in German? Like, they've sent the most valuable person on their team out to do a menial task.
And there's one nice little point in which one of these guys who had asked her comes and delivers her a cup of coffee.
Yeah. So there's nice little moments like that. I wanted to talk about the way this movie looked, because I didn't like the way it was shot at all, and it started to bother me about, it's not just this movie.
But you didn't think it was intentionally retro?
Yeah, and I don't like that. I don't like the fact that they're like, oh, well, it was the 1970s, so everything was just beige. And I know a lot of stuff was beige, but the movie is so underlit. The shaky cam is out of control, and it's just a way of trying to create tension when the tension kind of already exists in the performances. I agree with you that the editing is good. I think Feldbaum has a good sense of pacing and tension. But yeah, I don't know. I just thought it was like, you know, it's like a hat on a hat a little bit. And so many movies now look like this, and I just sit there going, eh, I
we're
wish,
all
you know.
Airing our little pet peeves.
Yeah, yeah, kind of.
Well, John Magaro, I mean, you might recognize him because he was in Past Lives.
And he was in First Cow.
Right. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. And so I was impressed by what he did here because his part, I mean, he has the emotional energy in some respects of this movie.
It's really his movie.
Yeah. And I think that for those of us who were living sentient beings during this time, I mean, it was horrific to go back and review, you know, what transpired here. But then it was sort of like, is the other character the audience? Like, so this is one of the first times where they're engaging in making these decisions about what to show on television. Mm-hmm. And now it's like any given day, any given minute, you can tune in and see whatever.
And there's also this element of them sort of patting themselves on the back for portraying it in the quote-unquote right way and then having to immediately eat their words because they didn't get it right. And so there is this sense of, you know, as a journalist, as a TV producer, as whatever, a person in the media, sort of trying to almost insert yourself and your own pride and your own sense of ethics into the thing. How much do you do of that? So there are some interesting things happening, you know.
There are a lot of interesting things.
I just think ultimately, I think it is a bit simplistic in the broader picture. But again, I think that there are other things that you could watch that would make the picture more complete.
Okay, so one last thing. Please keep in mind that the Jewish Film Festival is still screening films through this weekend. And also, there are online opportunities to watch films as well.
Thank you, MP. At any rate, that was our discussion of September 5th. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Nickel Boys. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the comedian and political commentator Jon Stewart. The Oscars is the one night of the year when you can see all your favorite stars without having to donate any money to the Democratic Party. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.